Advertising your business with GCN is simple, effective,
and more affordable than you might think.
Visit advertise.gcnlive.com for more info. Take your business to the next level.
Welcome back to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio. And now, here's Gene Steinberg.
I don't know if you knew Major Kehoe or not, Kevin, but was that your perception? I didn't get the impression, the more I hear about him in latter years, although I met him a few times, that he wasn't that great an investigator.
Back, and I forget the years, the Australians started doing UFO investigations. They created a military organization to investigate UFOs. And what the first thing they did was, their Air Force officers contacted our Air Force officers, and they asked about Don Kehoe. And the Air Force officer said, yeah, you can't believe what the guy says. It's all made up. It's all hearsay. He just didn't do a good job. And the Australian Air Force kind of backed off from their investigation based on that analysis of Kehoe's work. What you find out later is that a lot of stuff that Kehoe said in his books turned out to be true. And that kind of annoyed the Australians because they had been led down this primrose path by our Air Force officers suggesting Kehoe wasn't all that good. And you're right, they did an awful lot of anecdotal research, but then the next question becomes, when does anecdotal observation become scientific observation? Do you have to have a scientific degree to make credible observations of a phenomenon that you have witnessed? And how is the information gathered? And I think that Kehoe's role morphed from kind of chiding the Air Force and advocating for congressional investigations and that sort of thing, morphed into directing directing NICAP and away from the investigations. The investigations was left to the other NICAP members. And there was a NICAP member who was in Level Land, and a lot of his investigations made it into the NICAP files on the topic as well. So Kehoe, I think that's kind of a misnomer that he wasn't real good at the investigation. I think that his attention got diverted, but a lot of the information he put in his books was accurate. Sometimes he misinterpreted the information, and I think specifically on the Mantell incident, that was the Air National Guard pilot was killed chasing a UFO in 1948. And Kehoe, in his book, mentions that the object was seen over one of these Kentucky towns at a certain time, and it was seen over another Kentucky town at a later time. And if you measure the distance and divide it by the time, you find out the object was flying at 200 miles an hour. But what I discovered was, if you take a look at the directions the people were reporting the object, it was actually between the two towns. It was probably at 80,000 feet. And what you have is a report when it was first sighted in those towns, which may not be a relevant time. So it wasn't traveling at 200 miles an hour. It could have been traveling at 10 or 12 miles an hour. It's based on when the object was seen and where it was when it was seen. And so he drew a conclusion based on his interpretation of the information that was incorrect. But that, I think that, you know, we all can make those sorts of investigative mistakes if we're not careful with our research or we're pushing for an agenda. And sometimes too often, the reporting is agenda-driven. I looked for the best information I could find, and that was kind of how Chasing Footnotes was created, was I would look at a sighting, and I would see how far back I could go. I would chase the footnotes in books. Where did it come from? And go from book to book to book until I could find the original source. And if I could get to the original source, I could compare it with what was said in these subsequent books, and oftentimes it didn't bear much of a resemblance. Frank Edwards, for example, talked about a sighting in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, by a railroad engineer that was reported in the newspapers prior to Kenneth Arnold reporting his flying saucers, his discs. And I was very interested in this because I wanted a sighting that did not rely on Arnold, that predated Arnold by a few days, talking about disc-shaped objects because they thought that would be interesting or information important to countering what some of the skeptics were saying. And I followed that information as far as I could, and I finally found the article in the Cedar Rapids Gazette, and it turned out the sighting wasn't in Cedar Rapids. It was in Peoria, Illinois. And although he said he made the sighting on the afternoon of June 24th, it wasn't reported until like June 27th or June 28th, so it did not meet the criterion I was looking for. And so Edwards' information was substantially correct, but it wasn't in the newspaper on the afternoon that I wanted it to be. And Edwards had said you can read it in the newspaper on June 24th, and it wasn't there. So, that's the kind of thing that you have to look for. But sometimes you can only go so far, and you have to give up the trail. Kurt, I'm sure you know about that in your flying saucers that time forgot.
There's so many instances where it's a game of telephone. Things are repeated over and over, and sometimes without any malice or intent to deceive, just rewording something, you add a shading and it just carries it further and further from the truth. And so many, well, we'll just call them poor researchers, because honestly that's what they are, they'll rely on the previous printed version. It's basically copy and paste journalism, and it just takes us into really inaccurate territory.
Well, I think a lot of the people writing UFO books look at another UFO book and pull the case out of there, and they don't go to the original source. They figure this guy must have looked at it, and so they assume that he's researched it to its very end, so his information is accurate. One of the things that happened was when I was writing Crash When UFOs Fall from the Sky, and I was looking at the Del Rio crash, which I think a lot of us believed when it first came out, because here's an Air Force officer, high-ranking Air Force officer, colonel, telling about his involvement with this crash of a flying saucer near Del Rio, Texas in 1948. And there's an affidavit that he signed laying this whole thing out. And so when I got to writing Crash, I thought, well, let's see what the Internet says. And I found out there was a book by Noah Torres and Ruben Yarte called The Other Roswell, and this was the Del Rio crash, and it was Robert Willingham. And I talked to Noah Torres mostly about this, and I said, you guys looked at his background. I said, oh, yeah, his background's solid. And we've got his documentation. But they hadn't verified the documentation. They had pictures of him in the 1960s in Air Force uniforms. And they said, well, we'll send you the pictures. And they did. And I looked at the uniform. I said, that's not an Air Force uniform. That's a Civil Air Patrol uniform. That's a completely different kettle of fish. In fact, on my blog, I actually have pictures of him in that uniform, and he's wearing the metal plate on the uniform that Civil Air Patrol officers wore. It says Civil Air Patrol Official Auxiliary of the Air Force. I mean, it's right on his uniform, and he's wearing a CAP instead of a U.S. or the rank insignia on both sides. So he wasn't an Air Force, high-ranking Air Force officer, and I got his records from St. Louis. He'd spent 13 months in the Air Force, in the military. He'd been in the Army and got out of the Army as an E-4. And he said he was a World War II veteran, which was technically correct, because he joined the Army in December of 1945. And everybody knows the shooting stopped in Europe in May of 1945 and in the Pacific in September of 1945. But he was technically a veteran of World War II, because if you served up until 1946, the middle of 1946, the war was declared officially over. So at that point, anybody who served in that period of time as well were considered veterans of World War II. And the whole story just completely began to fall apart, because 1948 wasn't the right year for it. Although I found in Skylook, which is a precursor to the MUFON Journal, I think it's March of 1968, there's a paragraph about Willingham seeing a crashed flying saucer, giving it in 1948. So I actually found the original article. Len Stringfield talked about it, but then we see they changed the date to December of 1950, and it's Guerrero Indio, Mexico, where the thing is found. And then when I talked to Willingham, he made it 1954, 1955, something like that. But his original documents didn't bear him out. He wasn't an Air Force officer. He wasn't a fighter pilot. He had told me that he got out of the Air Force because he was injured in Korea. He never served in Korea, but he was injured in Korea, and they wouldn't let him fly anymore, fighters anymore. So he got out and got in the Air Guard where he could fly fighters. Well, I was in the Army National Guard at the time, and we were working closely with a lot of guys from the Air National Guard, and I knew a bunch of fighter pilots, and I asked them about it. And they said they could think of no injury that would disqualify him from flying fighters.
We got more to come. Trying to chase some footnotes here with Kevin, Gene, and Kurt. You're in
the Paracast.
Do you need a website? Well, you can get a great deal on hosting services with Namecheap's legendary coupon code. They're offering substantial hosting discounts on shared hosting, business hosting, VPS hosting, reseller hosting, and even dedicated servers. Namecheap is preferred by millions. It's backed by a money-back guarantee. Use the coupon code LEGENDARY to cash in on this special deal at Namecheap.com, Namecheap.com.
First came Attack of the Rockoids, and it was a critically acclaimed success. And now there is The Coming of the Protectors. A former military intelligence man is contacted by a space woman in a dream. A dream that turns out to be a nightmare, because evil forces on her distant planet are planning to conquer the Earth. This is gripping science fiction of the classic kind. Attack of the Rockoids and The Coming of the Protectors. Find out more at Rockoids.com. That's Rockoids, Rockoids.com.
No matter if supply lines are down, product deliveries are slow, and that most everything costs more these days, you still have neck and shoulder pain, right? Good news. Sunny Bay has new products that target neck and shoulder pain. Products that are in stock now, ready to ship anywhere now. Like our extra long neck heating pads. They provide soothing relief to painful sore necks and backs. You can heat them in a microwave oven, and they come in a variety of colors and patterns. And for stress relief, get our lavender scented hands-free neck wraps. Or maybe you need one of our smaller lower back wraps. Great for seniors. Again, there's no shipping delays from Sunny Bay. Find our new products on Amazon, Walmart, Etsy, and sunny-bay.com. Just search for Sunny Bay neck wraps. All our products are great for men or women, are reusable, and easy to clean. Remember, just search for Sunny Bay neck wraps. Order now because stock is high and shipping is fast. From Sunny Bay.
G'day, I'm Jamel that works with Dr. Joel Wallach and the GCN team with Youngevity at teamg'day.com. By becoming an associate, you provide income for you and your family on your own hours while working from home. So contact me, Jamel, by filling in the contact box at teamg'day.com, and I will get back to you personally and provide all the support you need to get started and build your Youngevity business. Teamg'day.com. Teamg'day.com.
Stop aging now. Restore those joints. Boost your strength. Because it's official. NutraMedical has released the most exciting, powerful anti-aging supplement on the market. Dr. Bill Deagle's Red Deer Velvet DR has been approved by the U.S. Patent Office. Imagine stem cell rejuvenation all in one capsule without huge expense. Dr. Bill MD discovered that as an unborn baby grows in the mother's womb, he or she does not deteriorate or physically age. Red Deer Velvet DR, like the uterus, provides 300 biomolecules and 6 hormones protected in one special DR capsule that delivers lipid packages directly into your circulation. This patented technology bypasses the stomach and is released into the small bowel unaltered by digestive enzymes and stomach acid. Remember, Red Deer Velvet DR. Improve endurance, stimulate your immune system, increase learning ability, and even improve sexual libido with Red Deer Velvet DR. Click NutriMedical.com. That's N-U-T-R-I Medical.com. Or call toll-free 888-212-8871 and get on the road to a newer, rejuvenated, happier you.
A lot can happen in 6 seconds. A rodeo ride, a dramatic basketball win, and the world record holder can solve a Rubik's Cube. 6 seconds is how long it takes for an 18-wheeler traveling at a safe speed to come to a complete stop. And in those 6 seconds, that truck will travel the length of 2 football fields. So please, give them room. Never cut in front of a large truck for any reason. Our roads, our responsibility. Learn more at sharetheroadsafely.gov.
We'd like to hear from you. If you have a comment or question about the Paracast, send it to news@theparacast.com. That's news@theparacast.com. And don't forget to visit our famous Paracast community forums at forum.theparacast.com.
So you're tracking down this guy's claims?
Yeah,
about his service? Go on, please.
Yeah, he said that they took him out of fighters. on active duty because of his injuries, but they allowed him to fly fighters in the Air National Guard. And the guys I talked to said, no, the problem was he could have become a bomber pilot, not a bomber pilot because there's some ejection seats there. He could have been a transport pilot. But the problem was in the fighters, it was the ejection seat. And if he couldn't qualify in the ejection seat in the active service, he wouldn't be flying in the guard as a pilot as well. So his story broke down because of what he was saying about those sort of things. He wasn't a pilot. I can find no record that he was a pilot other than a private pilot. And that was one of the other things that kind of got my attention. I know every military pilot I've ever talked to who has an FAA license, and I have one, is a commercial, at least a commercial pilot's license, because when we got out of flight school, we had 210 hours of flight time. And we were told as we were going on leave that if we waited a day, we could take an FAA examination. It's 50 questions on federal regulations. We would have classes and then we'd take the test. And we would be issued a commercial pilot's license. Willingham had a private pilot's license. There is no way that a military pilot is going to have a private pilot's license. He would go for the commercial pilot's license. When I got out of the Army and I came home, I was on my way to visit relatives, and I stopped off at the FAA office in Des Moines, Iowa, and took my 50-question test, barely passed it, but I did, and got my commercial pilot's license. There was no way that a military pilot is going to only have a private pilot's license. I looked up his private pilot's license on the FAA website, which you can't do anymore because of privacy issues, but I was able to find that out. So the whole story broke down, but the point is, you know, chasing the information to the very end and seeing what you can find and seeing how credible the sources are. That's important to do when we're talking about this stuff. And oftentimes the guys writing books at one end, they believe the others have done the research and they believe the information is accurate, and they're only interested in producing the book and not really doing the investigations.
That makes for kind of a sad situation there where you're giving repetition to repetition. And I think when you talk about the original version being corrupted through generation and generation of magazine article, the book, etc., this old joke, I guess Steve Allen used to do it on his show, where he brings up several people from the audience. He tells the first person quietly, whispering in his ear, a joke. And then that person, in turn, repeats the joke to the second person, whispers it. By the time you get to number 5 or number 10, the joke doesn't work, has nothing to do with the original. It's going through all these generations. And you think about all these people writing, and then a book goes through an editor, and they change a few words here and there to clean things up, and you can see where something gets corrupted, even if it wasn't intended to be corrupted.
Well, I think the other problem you have is people believe that the books are fact-checked, and they rarely are fact-checked. The only person doing the fact-check is the writer of it. You have a copy editor, and she or he is making sure that the information tracks properly, that you didn't say up here it was 1954 and down here you said it was 1955 or something like that, correlating that sort of information, but they're not seeing if the information is correct. I got into an argument with an editor on one of my books about Vietnam. One of the characters in the book had an M79 grenade launcher, and he said, well, they didn't have those in Vietnam. And I said, well, how do you know that? And he said, well, I've got a friend, and he told me they didn't have those in Vietnam. I said, well, I'm kind of surprised, because my roommate in Vietnam, he had an M79 grenade launcher. I don't know what you're talking about. I had a friend from flight school who was injured stupidly by himself, was firing an M79 in Vietnam, and he kept elevating the barrel to see how far he could launch it, and it hit wires overhead, and the round detonated at that point and threw shrapnel on them. So he was kind of cut up by that sort of thing. But, you know, the editors don't always know everything, and an awful lot of time there is no real fact-checking going on. That's left to the writer to do the initial fact-check. So if you're just putting together a book. In fact, I had an interview with a guy named Peter Strasberg. And Kurt, I meant to talk to you about this yesterday, who wrote a book about Einstein going to Roswell. And in the book, he had a bunch of information that he thought supported the idea about that, and it was the MJ-12 stuff. He thought that proved that Einstein had gone to Roswell, and I kept asking him about, well, didn't you do this, didn't you do that? He said, well, I found it on the Internet. I thought it looked good, and I just put it in the book for people to see. And I said, well, if you've vetted the information at all, you'd have realized that those documents you've presented in your book are bogus. They're fraudulent. It wasn't the original MJ-12 documents, some of the later stuff that came out. And I would ask him questions about the depth of his research into this. And he said, well, I put it together for the entertainment of my patients. I didn't do a lot of research. And I think a lot of books end up that way. We're going to exploit the interest in the topic right now, and you call up some guy, say, can you write a book about flying saucers? And I said, sure, and he grabs a bunch of books and newspaper articles, and he throws the book together, and he doesn't bother to check to see if the information is out of date or if it's changed. And that was kind of what led me to the Willingham stuff. I was checking to see if the information that we had from the 1970s about Willingham was accurate, and I found out it was not. And so I think that's part of the problem we run into. But when you take a look at the books, not a lot of fact-checking goes on. And in today's environment, you now have fact-checkers whose personal bias get in the way of the facts. You know, they don't want to believe something, so they say this is factually false, and it may not be factually false. So we have to run that gambit as well, or gauntlet as well.
That's a lot to digest, but yeah, a lot of hoaxes get repeated the same way. Now, you just mentioned two things I wanted to ask you about, so which one do you want to deal with first, Vietnam or MJ-12?
Well, what about Vietnam? We'll go with that first.
Okay, well, so we know you already had an interest in UFOs, and there have been numerous reports of unidentified, mysterious aircraft, helicopters, or otherwise. I'm just wondering, as your time is in Vietnam as a pilot, did you see or hear anything about UFOs?
No, I did not hear anything about UFOs. My grandmother actually sent me a copy of Frank Edwards' Flying Saucer Serious Business while I was there because she knew about my interest in UFOs. The only thing that came close is there was a French Alouette helicopter. wasn't ours. wasn't any of our allies. And we chased it back into Cambodia. But that was a real life helicopter, not anything mysterious. It was, I think, North Vietnamese. I saw nothing in Vietnam about UFOs or anything like that. And the same thing in Iraq. I understand there were some sightings. I had access to all the intelligence reports that were going on through a classified internet connection. And I never saw anything about UFOs. Had I seen anything, I would have noted it, but I didn't see anything. And of course, we were looking for things a lot closer to the ground in UFOs, but I didn't see anything in Iraq either. I know others have claimed to have seen things, and I know people have told wild stories about their experiences with UFOs in Vietnam, but I just had nothing like that happen to me.
Well, that before going on to the MJ-12, that makes me want to ask this question. Do you think that there have been sightings that have been maybe overhyped as UFOs that were really unidentified aircraft?
Before you answer that question, Kevin Randall, author of a new book on Leveland, published by Flying Disc Press, and we're now talking about a lot of ancillary topics with Kurt Collins, our guest co-host. You're in the Paracast.
Listening to GCN. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Silver has always been nature's very own antibiotic, and only one system allows you to generate an endless supply of natural silver solutions. SilverLungs.com. You'll find no wild claims or pseudoscience, just a lifetime of nano-sized pure silver solutions. The Silver Lungs generator allows you to make your own, so stop paying for silver solutions. The unique lung delivery system targets respiratory infections where other silver solutions simply cannot reach. See the Silver Lungs generator and lung delivery system at SilverLungs.com. That's SilverLungs.com.
What if you could cut your heating bills this winter with your existing wood-burning fireplace and not spend thousands doing it? You can with Great Wall of Fire Fireplace Grates. Our U.S.-patented, made-in-America Wall of Fire Grates increase fireplace efficiency, eliminate fireplace smoke problems, and come with a 30-day money-back guarantee. See our grates in action and get free shipping from wallofire.com or call 800-274-7364. Fireplace heat without fireplace smoke. Wallofire.com.
USA Radio News with Chris Barnes.
Democratic Senator Kristen Sinema's office is responding to her censure by the Arizona Democratic Party as Saturday's censure vote came after Sinema voted in favor of keeping the Senate filibuster in place, which effectively killed passage of two major voting rights bills. Arizona spokeswoman Hannah Hurley saying in a statement, Sinema, quote, promised Arizonians she would be an independent voice for the state and not for either political party. The Prime Minister of New Zealand now canceling her wedding because of the Omicron outbreak. Jacinda Ardern was planning to marry her longtime partner Clark Gayford sometime during the Southern Hemisphere summer. The Prime Minister now says that her wedding has been called off as her country struggles with that outbreak. An Oklahoma lawmaker filing a bill that would make the Bible Oklahoma's official state book. And this is USA Radio News. Gun violence on an upswing in New York City again lately, and the new city mayor, Eric Adams, held a roundtable yesterday to address the problem, commemorating those who work in law enforcement for all of the crime they've stopped simply by being on the job in the city.
You looking at the shooting that happened, look at the ones that did not happen.
That's right.
Because you were there.
That's right.
You know, so we talk about how many runs a batter knock in, we don't say how many runs are saved by the shortstop, you know. And so I know that, you know, you're stopping a whole lot of beefs and battles and retaliatory shootings. I'm aware of that. Don't listen to the noise. Let's stay focused and not get distracted.
A snake wrangler had to be called in to remove dozens of snakes from a home in Maryland where a man was found dead a few days ago. The count currently standing at 124 snakes removed, and they're still looking for more. This is USA Radio News.
As Dr. Wallach says, we all have nutrient deficiencies in our diets and must supplement with 90 essential nutrients in proper balances. At no cost or obligation, get a personal certified holistic health coach to help you develop a supplement program based on Dr. Wallach's recommendations. Call Linda at 833-VITAL-90. That number to call is 833-848-2590. That's 833-VITAL-90.
Hi, this is Dr. Joel Wallach, the mineral doctor. You've heard me talk about 90 for life for years. 60 minerals, 16 vitamins, 12 amino acids, 2 fatty acids. You may not know this, that I've actually designed Arthrodex for animals. That's right. Your pets need 90 for life, too. Get this essential pet product by calling 877-279-9422. That's 877-279-9422. Again, 877-279-9422.
Clark, author of the UFO Encyclopedia and other books. You're listening to the Paracast.
Okay, Kirk Collins asked you a question in our last segment. Kevin, would you respond?
I think that you're dealing with a lot of people in Vietnam whose training might not have been as robust as mine. And I say that my advanced individual training, my AIT, was flight school, so we were like there for months. Infantry school, you had 8 weeks of basic training, and then you'd go on to AIT, which was another 8 weeks of more intensive in infantry training and that kind of thing. Or you might have gone to artillery school or whatever. And there was a lot of stuff flying around in Vietnam with weird configurations and things like that. So I would imagine that more than one time somebody may have seen something they thought was alien or unusual that was part of a mission. I flew one Firefly mission with a friend from flight school. We had to evacuate our aircraft because there was rumors of an attack on our base, and we flew our aircraft out of there, and it turned out we were being housed with another unit. And actually, this is on my blog on Vietnam Ground Zero. Now, blogspot.com, it's Flying Firefly. But Firefly was a Huey helicopter with a cluster of landing lights in it, and they would fly around with those lights at night trying to spot nefarious activity, and they had gunships around to engage and that sort of thing. And I can imagine something like that would, if you just caught a glance of it or you didn't get a good look at it, might create some kind of impression of a unusual craft, or the configuration of landing lights on aircraft, or configuration of lights on other craft might cause some confusion. But like I said, I didn't see anything in Vietnam that there, either through the briefings we had to sit through or myself, I never saw anything that was confusing or confounding that I couldn't explain. And in Iraq, given that I had In our battalion, I had one of the few top secret clearances. I had access to a lot of information that the rest of the unit didn't have, and I was part of my job was to review that information coming over the CIPRNet.
You know, that kind of surprises me in a way, because UFOs are supposed to be a worldwide phenomenon. So you think Vietnam, Iraq, there've got to be sightings.
But the fact that I didn't see them it doesn't mean there weren't sightings. It just means I didn't see them. The things I was looking for in Iraq were intelligence information that would impact our follow-on missions where we were operating. So the fact I didn't see them doesn't mean that they weren't there somewhere, but it wasn't where I was looking for stuff because of what my mission was and what I needed to do. So the fact I didn't see anything is not really a completely relevant statement. It just means I didn't see anything. It doesn't mean it wasn't there.
So can we ask a question about MJ-12 now?
If you feel you must.
Okay. So first of all, I think most people know that listen to this show and reading your material know that the documents are bogus. So a friend of mine, a researcher, Shepard Johnson, who's really interested in some of the intrigue, wants to know, first of all, do you know anything about the background of Lee Graham and what role he played?
Well, Lee Graham didn't have much of a role to play. He just he got his information from Bill Moore. And Bill Moore, I think Sam Friedman is the one that said that Bill Moore had a habit of playing games with people. And he once showed a MUFON ID card, or maybe an APRO ID card, to Bill Graham, suggesting it was some kind of government agency that he worked for. And Graham kind of went away with that. But I think that Moore talked about or showed him the documents prior to them getting out into the public arena. So Graham's source of the original MJ-12 documents, the information he had, and I think he may have communicated some of that to Barry Greenwood for his publications. I think it was a Just Cause, I think it was in at that time. But Graham was interested in UFOs, and his source for the MJ-12 information is Bill Moore. And if you trace it to Bill Moore, then you've kind of fallen off the rails at that point.
So if MJ-12 is a con, then Lee Graham was the mark.
Yes, one of many.
Okay. And there were a couple other related questions. So I think we know a little bit about Jamie Shandira. He was in television, and he received the documents. They were mailed to him, probably by a partner, or maybe he was a target. What did you think about him, and do you know what became of him? Because he kind of dropped out of the UFO field.
I met him one time in Roswell in 1997, and we didn't chat very much. And I've always tried to figure out, I'm going to leak documents into the public arena about UFOs. So I pick some obscure guy that I don't know to leak these documents to. I didn't pick, I don't know, Stan Friedman, Jim and Cora Lorenzen, Don Kehoe, people who are at the top of the UFO field. I don't leak them to the New York Times or Newsweek. I leak them to some guy in Hollywood that may have no access to the media or no.
It's almost like the contactees, where all these totally unknown people living in small towns meet E.T. and E.T. says, now go forth and convey our message, evangelize our message of peace and brotherhood. It's almost the same thing as contacting some unknown guy in Hollywood.
And the other thing you have to remember is Jamie Shandira and Bill Moore and Bob Pratt, and I don't want to say anything bad about Bob Pratt, because I think he was a good guy, had written a novel in, I think, 1980, and Brad Sparks and Barry Greenwood laid this all out at the MUFON Symposium, and the information was then later published in the MUFON Journal, showing that they'd written a novel which was the basis of MJ-12. And then when the MJ-12 documents leaked, Bob Pratt got a hold of Moore and said, maybe we ought to dust the novel off that they hadn't been able to sell and take advantage of this, but that never happened. And they do a good analysis of all of that sort of thing. I did an update of my book on MJ-12 called Case MJ-12, which is an updated version of that. And it lays out some of the stuff about Lee Graham and how he was brought into this. And it delves into what Barry Greenwood And Brad Sparks found about MJ-12 and all of that stuff and looks at some of the work done by the Woods, Bob Woods and Ryan Woods, and their belief in MJ-12. And one of the things that came up is Stan Friedman told me at one point that Bill Moore had asked him about creating a document, like it's a government document that he could show to witnesses to suggest the information is out and maybe induce them to talk to him about these hidden secrets. And apparently Stan was somewhat enthusiastic about it, but he also talked to Brad Sparks, and Sparks says, no, this is a bad idea. And lo and behold, MJ-12 shows up. And what is it? Oh. Classified government document talking about the crash at Roswell and that sort of thing.
Well, Ben, you're basically suggesting here that perhaps, just perhaps, and he's no longer with us to answer the question, Stan Friedman may have been in part instrumental in the creation of MJ-12.
I don't think he was involved in the creation of MJ-12. I think he was left out of that sort of thing. He may have suspected where it suspected where it came from, but I don't think he was involved. He became a big advocate for it, and at one point he talks about how he never said to me that Bill Moore talked about creating a document, and that's not true. And actually, Don Schmidt had told me that earlier, and I was surprised when Stan confirmed it about that. And then, of course, we have Bill Moore talking to Brad Sparks about it as well. So it's clear that Moore had delved into this idea and talked to all of these people. So I think Stan suspected what happened, but it was important for Stan's work that MJ-12 be authentic. So he went out of his way to authenticate it, overlooking some of the flaws in the document. I mean, it's clearly was created in the mid-1980s. Although it's dated 1952, the information in the document is clearly from the mid-1980s, which has now been superseded by other and additional information showing that those documents were not created by insiders.
Hey, we have more inside stuff in our next segment with Kevin, Gene, and Kurt. You're in
the Paracast.
For listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Hey, listeners. I want you to have the entire Paracast experience. So I'd like to tell you about After the Paracast. After the Paracast is an exclusive feature for subscribers to the Paracast Plus. With After the Paracast, you never know what's going to happen next. After the Paracast features color commentary, special interviews, and further conversations with Paracast guests. With Paracast Plus, you can download a very special enhanced version of the Paracast also. We do offer exclusive music, videos, and more features are coming. To get more info about subscribing, please visit theparacast.plus. Once again, theparacast.plus. Prices are just $1.50 a week, less than a cup of coffee at your local convenience store. Check out theparacast.plus to learn more about Paracast Plus.
It's a fact. The best time to prepare for bad times is during good times. When you know a big storm is coming, you prepare in advance. Same goes for our future. Things seem calm right now. So it's the perfect time to prepare for the next big crisis or disaster. That's why you should stock up on emergency food from MyPatriotSupply.com. We're America's largest preparedness company, with millions of happy, well-prepared customers. Our food kits stay fresh for up to 25 years. They're an insurance policy you can eat. When you need it, it'll be there. Shop dozens of food storage kits now at MyPatriotSupply.com. Our kits give you an abundance of food, totaling over 2,000 calories a day. Every family member in America needs one of these kits. So go to MyPatriotSupply.com and grab a few. That's MyPatriotSupply.com. Do it before the peanut butter hits the fan again. MyPatriotSupply.com.
Now, with orders to stay at home, public health concerns, the reality of illness due to pathogens and viruses, your health is at an all-time high risk. That's why it's critical to take a proactive approach to boost your immune system. You can with new nano-colloidal silver from Americare. Our patented process with tiny silver particles, 1/100th the size of a red blood cell, allows for maximum body absorption. Americare's nano-colloidal silver effectively disinfects your body internally, attacking pathogens and viruses while supercharging your immune system. Colloidal silver is antibacterial and antiviral. Simply put, it prohibits bacterial respiration, suffocating viral cells, preventing the virus from replicating. And now, due to public health concern, Americare is authorized to offer our lowest and best price ever, around $1 a day, but supplies are limited. Purchase nanocolloidal silver now at immunesupportnow.com. That's immunesupportnow.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Supplies are limited.
Jake was in big trouble with the IRS. He owed how much?
$92,000.
Ouch. The IRS left no room for Jake to breathe.
They put a lien on my house, took all the money out of my bank account, took money out of my paychecks. So it was a nightmare.
He needed help fast.
I figured that all these companies were the same until I called Federal Tax Management. You could just tell they knew what they were talking about. Right then and there, I felt like I had some hope.
Stop the liens, levies, and garnishments fast and qualify for one of several special IRS programs that could reduce or even eliminate your tax debt. So, how'd it go for Jake?
They did what they said they would do. They came through for me. I ended up saving an unbelievable amount. I was so jazzed. I was extremely happy.
If you owe more than $10,000 in back taxes, take Jake's advice.
Give Federal Tax Management a phone call. If they help me, they can help anybody.
Call the Federal Tax Management Hotline now. 800-503-8625. 800-503-8625. 800-503-8625.
Hi, it's Grant Cameron from PresidentialUFO.com. You're listening to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio.
So, therefore, it has a 1980s sensibility, MJ-12, supplanted by real knowledge. What has happened to Bill Moore? Is he still alive?
As far as I know, he's still alive. I was talking to someone several weeks ago who has been in recent contact with Bill Moore, and I don't remember who it was. So he's still around, but he's dropped off the ufological radar. I think he kind of committed ufological suicide back in 1989 when he was at the MUFON Symposium in Las Vegas and confessed to being a unpaid agent of the Air Force Office of Special Investigation and was doing their dirty work for them and supplying fake documents into the UFO community and that sort of thing. And after that, he became somewhat of a pariah in the UFO field. I don't know what he's done or where he's been since then. I know we got, I say we, Don Schmidt and I got into trouble with him. He was always going to sue us over talking about Roswell. And I'm thinking, back in the early 1990s, if I wasn't being threatened with a lawsuit at some point, I figured I wasn't doing the job right because we were getting all kinds of threats of lawsuits. And I'm always thinking, yeah, come ahead. Yeah, tell us about how you gathered these documents under oath in a court of law. That'll be interesting.
What were you threatened for in terms of lawsuits?
Well, we're just talking about Roswell, for God's sakes. Stan Friedman actually wrote our publisher and said that we, Don Schmidt and I, engaged in flights of fantasy and stolen other researchers' information and passed it off as our own. And I'm thinking, that's really nice, Stan, just because we wouldn't allow you to horn in on our book. He proposed to us at one point that his name go third on our book and he get a quarter of the money for the book, and he said no. So I spent literally 24 hours on the telephone with the lawyers at Avon, not all at one time, obviously. But finally, one of the lawyers said, did you record your interviews? And I said, for the most part, yeah. And he said, thank you, goodbye. Because we could prove we'd gathered the information. And then we see Stan's book come out, Crash of Corona, and there's interviews that Don and I conducted. And Stan is published them as if they're his own without any credit or attribution to us. And we were always very careful to attribute where the information came from. And Stan's got information in his book that Don and I had gathered and shared with him. And he's reporting it as if he had gathered it.
Talk about rehashing.
Well, and then the interesting thing, Dolan, in his books, is talking about some of the Roswell stuff. And the funny thing is he quotes the source of the information to Stan Friedman. And it goes to Stan Friedman and stops. But I knew where it came from because I gathered the information and Don had gathered the information.
Well, so what's your evaluation of Richard Dolan's research?
I haven't followed a lot of it. There are some chasing footnote errors in there, and I've talked about those on my blog. But for me, I know, Kurt, you do it more on an active basis. I always kind of blunder into these things. Somebody says something, and I'm trying to figure out where it came from and how we got there. And I found a couple of things in Dolan's book, like that reference to, I think it's the Bill Brazel interview that Don and I had conducted in 1989. Dolan references Stan's book. And there's nothing in Stan's book to suggest where it came from. But like I said, I knew where it came from. I think he gathered an awful lot of stuff. I think he followed it up as best he could. He treated it more as a historic project than a scientific project. And the difference, the way the methodology for between a scientific investigation and a historical investigation is somewhat different.
I know that when I had met him the first or second time, I had read his first UFO book, and I looked at it, and I noticed something about Kehoe that was dead wrong, and I corrected him, but that doesn't mean anything. I mean, someone writes a book of a few hundred pages, I'd be surprised if there weren't errors.
Oh, yeah. And some of them are introduced by the copy editors, and some of them are just information that you get wrong and you don't catch it when you're proofing it yourself. I find it very hard to proofread my own work because I know what it's supposed to say.
What I do when I don't have another editor to work with is I read it two or three times, try to get rid of most of the errors, and then, of course, can still make the same mistakes. But at least it makes it more presentable, we hope.
I read the stuff out loud. And if you stumble over it, then you go back to see what you stumbled over. But I have my own cadence, my own rhythm in writing this stuff. And so I know what it's supposed to say. And I sometimes blow right back, right by the mistakes like that. So, I mean, you can find that. And there's in the history of UFO crashes, for example, I have the Willingham affidavit as if it's authentic. And here's the information from an Air Force colonel, a retired Air Force colonel, blah, blah, blah. And it wasn't until I was doing crash and I thought, well, I'll update the information and see if there's anything new about Willingham, and discovered the guy was complete fraud. So you can take a look and say, well, you know, Randall, you blew it there in the history of UFO crashes. And I'll say, I certainly did. But at the time, it was the best information that we had. I mean, Kufo swore by it, and we had the affidavit. And if I talked to Willingham at that time, he would have told me the same thing. So there was no way to get beyond that. It was only after I discovered the story had changed so significantly that I was getting information from the Record Center in St. Louis and a Record Center in Denver about Air Force Reserve personnel, and finding out the documents that he submitted were fraudulent and that he had never been an officer.
Let me ask you a quick question. Was he alive still when you learned about all this?
Yes.
Did you confront him?
I felt somewhat sorry for him because his wife had died. His children were dead. I think his children were dead. Let me say that. And he was living alone in Texas. And I called him and talked to him a little bit about that and gathered some information. I never really confronted him about the information, but I did put it in the book. Crash. I put the information in there, and I did an article, I think, for IUR about that as well, and how we chased that down. But I felt kind of sorry for the guy. He was like 109 years old when I talked to him, and I just made up the 109. But he was in his 80s, and his health was poor, and I just didn't feel it was right to confront him at that point.
Let him live with his fantasies. We're going to, of course, have to adjourn this segment, this episode of the Paracast, in a few moments, but Kevin will be back for After the Paracast. We will probe further into the R word and what further work he's doing on it. You think here, though, what motivates people to do what he did? Was it glory or profit or what?
I think it's just, there's a book called Stolen Valor, and it's about all these people who claim Vietnam service who were never there, never in the military. One of our senators, and I hesitate to bring up his name because he presented me with a Bronze Star Medal, but Tom Harkin had claimed to be a Vietnam veteran, and it turned out that he hadn't been in Vietnam. You know, so there was a judge in Illinois who claimed to have a Medal of Honor, and he got outed when it was discovered, you put in for the license plates, Medal of Honor license plates, and discovered that he wasn't a Medal of Honor recipient. I think it's just to make themselves sound better, more heroic. So that's kind of where we are.
Kevin Randall, please tell our listeners where they can find more of the stuff that you do.
Well, the blog is called kevinrandall.blogspot.com. There's a search engine on there, so if I've sent something today that's interesting, you can type in like Willingham's name. It'll bring up all the articles that I've written over the years about Willingham. I did a blog called vietnamgroundzero.blogspot.com, which I say is my relatively true experiences in Vietnam, and I say relatively true because reading some of the letters I sent home, I realized some of my memories weren't exactly accurate based on what I'd said in the letters. The book Level Land is available at Amazon. You can get it as an e-book or as a paperback, and there's a hardback edition coming from that as well for those who want to collect that sort of thing. All the books are available at Amazon as well, so you can find them there.
There are lots of them, by the way. You can find us on Twitter. If you look for the PowerCast, look for the PowerCast on Facebook, which is kind of messed up in not allowing us to use our URL on Facebook. I guess they don't like the PowerCast.com. It's going to send objects down to them and something like that. No. Anyway, it's going to hurt Zuckerberg. I guess he's afraid of us. You can get branded PowerCast merchandise at the PowerCast.shop. That's the PowerCast.shop. And we also offer the PowerCast Plus, where you get an enhanced ad-free version of this show. If you're a subscriber, also the After the PowerCast podcast with extra extended uncensored discussions. And Kevin will be back to talk about the R word and war on After the PowerCast. For more information, go to theparacast.plus. That's theparacast.plus. And get this, use the coupon code UFO20, that's UFO20, to get a 20% discount for 5-year and lifetime subscriptions to theparacast.plus. Kevin Randall, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for joining us on the PowerCast.
Glad to be here, and see you later, Kurt and Gene.
PowerCast, featuring Gene Steinberg, is a copyrighted presentation of Making the Impossible, Incorporated. Tune in next week for a new adventure in the PowerCast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNLive.com today.
Attack of the Rockoids has been well received by critics and readers alike. It's a thrill-a-minute story you'll never forget. A former U.S. military intelligence officer is haunted by intense dreams about a beautiful woman pleading for his help after a terrible battle in outer space. But the dreams turn out to be true and thrust him into a telepathic love affair with a woman whose faraway planet is intent on destroying the Earth. And now the gripping tale continues in The Coming of the Protectors. It's the second book of the Rockoids trilogy, a galaxy-spanning adventure that pits our hapless heroes against powerful, fanatical enemies that threaten the lives of freedom-loving beings everywhere. Attack of the Rockoids and The Coming of the Protectors, classic science fiction at its best, available now. For more details, visit Rockoids.com. That's Rockoids.com.
We've entered a time where sky truly is the limit and opportunity awaits. The Internet has become a platform of everyone's worldwide communications. Billionaires building businesses on platforms that didn't even exist a generation ago. But in the sea of noise, how can the voice of your business be heard? The secret is over 100 years old. Radio. 228% more effective than TV. That's 228% more effective than television. Brick and mortar and cyber businesses alike have found radio to be the most effective for building a brand and delivering customers. Learn the secrets of radio advertising by calling 877-996-4327 or email advertise at gcnlive.com. That's advertise at gcnlive.com.